Folks, welcome back to the iHealth channel, iHealth Radio, the NBC Network, The Works, with a terrific discussion today. We're in the world of healthcare, but my guest is a globally recognized pioneer in leadership, decision-making, and organizational culture. Dr. Thomas Kraus is the founder of Behavioral Science Technology and currently serves as chairman of the Kraus Bell Group. He's designed powerful culture change strategies to help organizations prevent catastrophic events, improve safety, and build thriving environments from the inside out. He's also authored 5 influential books, including Taking the Lead in Patient Safety and If Your Culture Could Talk. And of course, he's been featured in Wall Street Journal, Forbes, USA Today. I mean, we're going to have a treat today, and we're going to dive into the world in the healthcare. That's sometimes a topic we don't discuss much, which is a topic of safety and the culture of safety and how we do this, because this expertise, today is going to get us closer to this, and he does a terrific job about it. I'm going to call you Doc just to introduce you now. Doc, welcome to the show, but we're going to go with Tom. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, it is a true pleasure and honor. And, certainly your work is tremendous. And, I've done this for 5 years. And the idea was to bring in healthcare closer to the world and the eyes and the ears of people. And we've built in a good, listenership and a viewership. And the mission is really to bring in more information. And you know what's funny? This is one topic we haven't, we talked safety, security in general, but not in the healthcare space or in terms of culture. And the other thing is that I just had a show, we've talked about similar stuff, and we did not really focus on the culture of companies and things like that. So today, I think we have this tremendous opportunity with you. So Tom, let's talk about this. What got you into this whole world of really safety, world? I mean, and in the special the world of healthcare specifically.
So my doctoral training was in clinical psychology, and also I have a master's degree in experimental psychology. So I expected to do clinical work after I graduated. That's what I set out to do. I had a partner who was a physician, psychiatrist, and he and I had a practice together. And we almost incidentally bumped into a company, fairly large local organization. At this site, they had 1,100 employees. They were concerned about worker safety at that location. And they said to us, we understand the engineering side, but we don't understand the behavioral side. And I had studied applied behavior analysis in graduate school, and it was one of the things that I really liked. And I thought, there's so much stuff in psychology that is vague and hard to measure and sort of up in the air somewhere, hard to really feel like you know something in those areas. They're interesting, but knowledge is not empirically based often. But with applied behavior analysis, it was not that way. There was real content there, real data and measurable variables and how they fit together and all that. So when I heard we don't understand behavior very well, I thought, gosh, I do, and I could help you guys with that. And so they said, well, what do you? They said, we're having these incidents. People are getting hurt at work. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I think if I interviewed the people who are very close to the work, I'd probably get a sense of what was going on. Now, I hadn't read Deming at that time. I later read Deming, and that's exactly what he said we should do. And I don't know if you know Deming, he goes way back, but he's a hero in my mind. He was the sort of the guy that invented quality, went to Japan and taught the Japanese how to do quality in the automobile manufacturing industry, and then came back. He was a big hit in the 80s and 90s and so on. And then total quality management all came out of Deming's thinking. So I kind of bumped into the idea that the frontline employee would know stuff that was valuable to the leadership process. The closer to the work, the better. And so we interviewed 200 people Later, after we were doing this more often, we realized you don't have to interview 200 people out of 1,000, but we did in that first project, and we learned a ton, and we developed a system. And a year later, after implementing the system we developed, their injuries declined by 42%, which was way more than anybody thought would happen, and meant a lot to them financially and also in terms of their success and obtaining the kind of objectives they had about what kind of company they wanted. So we got another one and then another one, and over a period of years we just gradually moved out of the clinic and into the workplace and started a company, and we were off to the races.
Well, that's pretty amazing, because when you think safety, and when I even introduced it, I'm thinking like safety. We know what it is. There's a risk. People do different things. There's fall. There's all kinds of things that can happen in the workplace in general. I mean, there's even government agencies that oversee these things, right? And most of the regulatory has some sort of a level of quality included in there. But what I didn't connect is the idea of psychology and the risk. That's really the most amazing piece about just even considering that as a source of reason behind things that happen in the workplace, whether it's for the people that get injured or cause havoc or accidents, whatever you want to call them, but also I think the psychology when it comes to the leadership and how it all gets implemented and included in the vision of any company, right? So that's actually just phenomenal just to think about it, and I guess if you're watching or listening, you probably got the same feeling that I had, like, whoa, I didn't see that coming, actually, from your end. But really, your background is definitely beyond even what I've read about here, because you can dissect it from behavior stuff, and because you're right. I mean, people don't make mistakes just like that or do things that hurt, without having some sort of a psychological, reasoning behind it, right? I mean, we think of something, sometimes, or we don't think of something. That could be the lack of, right? So either way, you can do and put somebody in harm's way or even a company in harm's way for whatever reasons. And sometimes, it can be disastrous. So what are some of the common, I guess, blind spot, sometimes that, that you've discovered leaders have when it comes to shaping a culture of safety and behavior safety?
Yeah. Well, one thing is understanding the role of behavior. So when I started doing this, the general view was that most injuries occurred because of some kind of behavioral failure. And that was pretty much what everybody thought. There was a guy named Heinrich who had studied it way back, gosh, now 100 years ago, and written a book about it. And everybody in the safety, industrial safety world had read that book. And it said 85 to 90% of the time it was the worker who had done something unsafe that caused the event. But along the way, we learned, and many other people did too, it wasn't like we were the first to realize this, that the behavior of the worker is involved in it, but there are reasons that workers do things, and if those reasons are sometimes systemic. Mm-hmm. So it looks like the worker, but if you examine it very carefully, you see that there are factors going on that are way past the worker and sometimes go back for years, sometimes 4 years or 5 years. A decision was made in the purchase of equipment, let's say, and the decision was that this was cheaper than that, or this was more accessible than that, and for that reason, this kind of equipment was purchased rather than that kind of equipment. Without realizing that the kind of equipment that was less expensive also failed more frequently. And when it failed, it had to be repaired. And when it was repaired, it had to be shut down. And that meant locking it out. But that took time. And if you had a schedule of production, the worker was in the position of having to decide, do I lock this machine out or do I keep up with my production quota? I can't have both. And often, very often, the worker gets accustomed to doing it the unsafe way. So he doesn't lock it out. He goes in unlocked and works on it. And, you know, 99% of the time, that's okay. Nothing happens. But it's one time when some sequence of things all come together just exactly the wrong way, and that machine starts up while he's still got his hand in it or his body in it. And then he gets very seriously hurt or even killed. And still, when you look at that, then you say, well, what happened? Why did this thing happen? Well, the guy didn't lock it out. That's the answer. The person didn't lock it out. But while that is true, that the person didn't lock it out, it's really only a part of the story. The real story is a decision was made years and years ago that put the worker at risk, but nothing happened and everybody got used to it, and it became normalized. So the technical term for that is normalization of deviance, meaning we're deviating from the right way to do this, the safe way to do it, the way that makes sense, but we normalize that, we get used to it. So it's now it's okay. If you ask people, well, hey, how do you do when this machine, when it breaks, you know, what do you do?
We give it a kick.
Yeah. We kick it. Yeah. And on it goes back on and we're okay. So that's a hard concept, even like today, right now, that's a very hard concept to get across. And you have something quite similar in healthcare. Mm-hmm. Healthcare leader doesn't realize that the reason the nurse handed the wrong medication to the physician at a crucial time is not just because she made a mistake or he made a mistake. It's also
overworked, not sleeping.
Overworked, not sleeping, or the medication isn't stored properly. And so it's very easy to reach the wrong one inadvertently, because the storage is not the storage makes it ambiguous.
Well, Tom. So you know, it's amazing, because the example, for example, someone who get hurt in a machine. I mean, you know, we can see that in the industrial space, but we know there's other, in as you said, in the healthcare, it could be as simple as, you know, misdosing someone, or maybe, you know, putting the wrong medication, or sometimes, like, you know, people maybe get exposed to bio stuff, you know, biohazard, right? And again, that is, we know that, for example, in the 70s with HIV and AIDS, I mean, that was a huge thing, right? You know, and you have pandemics, or, you know, different, I guess, surges here and there of certain viruses that happened in the past. And even we just had the pandemic a few years back now. And, you know, we've seen that. I mean, you know, when you're not 100% aware and doing everything by the book, and the culture is not really helping. And I'm talking here, culture means the directives, because we got to get things done, right? Sometimes we often see this in general, is that profits come first, and therefore, you know, we can cut corners. And, you know, I think that's really the worst, you know, way to think about it. But then again, that falls on the leadership, you know, decision making. As you said, good example is, well, let's cut budget here. You know, I think we can do better with this machine. It does the trick. You know, for how long does it do the trick? That's one thing. And even if it does break, you know, is there a warranty? Can we do it, or can we just do a duct tape on it? And when, I mean, I had a partner before, he duct taped everything. That was the solution. So you know, I mean, I'm just being funny about this, but really, these are some serious things, and you don't think about it in general, right? I mean, everyone else is a consumer that walks into a healthcare facility, a job. I mean, you go to a warehouse just like for food shopping, right? I mean, these crates I see sometimes, I'm like, I'm wondering, like, are these even safe? I mean, people are moving things quick. They're rushing. They're putting things up. It's like, all it takes is one move that is wrong, and or something that a bolt that is loose, and everything goes in chaos. And we've seen actually video footage of things like that happening. So it is dangerous. But you know, so in your work, Tom, how, I mean, you kind of talked about the idea of the source, right? And there's different things that happen, but like, why does it happen that way? I mean, aren't leaders, you know, when they're given a position of authority, or even business owners, when they start a venture, don't they look at these things? I mean, because obviously there is lawsuits, there's all kind of stuff that can happen that destroys your image. There's PR, branding, all the stuff that can really bad for you. I mean, how does that work? I mean, there's gotta be more to this.
Yeah, well, it depends a lot on, there's a lot of variation across different industries, and there's a lot of variation across different organizations. So, in the, let's say, oil and gas industry, large organizations, they're really good at this stuff. They're the frequency of incidents that they have, the frequency of fatalities that they have, or even serious injuries, is extremely low. I mean, a big oil company, for example, might have, I don't know, 100,000 employees, and they could go for years without having a single fatality. On the other hand, a small contractor that works for an oil company could have 500 or 600 employees, and they could have a fatality every year or so. So there's a huge amount of variability depending on the size and the structure and how much attention is paid to it. Basically, in the process industries, oil and gas and chemical industries, where there's major hazard, where people can get killed and there are events, people can remember, Deepwater Horizon happened and six or seven people were killed, or the Brumadinho Dam in Brazil failed and several hundred people were killed, or the Space Shuttle Columbia. Big events like that happen and they grab everybody's attention, and leadership gets real serious about it and they work very hard on reducing those events. Now, that's not necessarily the case in healthcare. Healthcare is, as you know, a very unique industry and has its own set of variables and problems. The action of interest, in my opinion, in healthcare is not so much worker safety, which is a thing, and people work on it, and people do get hurt, sometimes even seriously in healthcare, but patient safety. And patient safety is actually a very, very significant national problem that has not been addressed very well. And the numbers of people who are killed in the healthcare system, even today, even right this year, is amazingly high and quite problematic.
Do you have any statistics on that that you have handy?
Yeah.
Let's get scared here, because I mean, everybody is worried about healthcare, right? I mean, we all somehow kind of use it one day or the other, whether basic stuff or you have family members that may need it. So it is important to actually bring that. So what are the statistics on that?
Well, that's part of the interesting thing. There's a giant controversy about how you measure patient fatalities. And it's just not at all clear what that number is. So in most industries, if a person is killed, there's a federal reporting requirement. And as a result of that, there's a metric. So you can say we have, for every 100 employees, we have X number of events. But healthcare doesn't have that. Healthcare doesn't have a national reporting standard. And so the truth is, nobody knows how many people are killed in the healthcare system. It has been studied, and it's been studied a lot, but those studies conflict. So the original study done about 20 years ago by the Institute of Medicine identified 40,000 healthcare-related fatalities, patient safety fatalities, 40,000. Now, to put that in context, in industry, the annual number is 5,000 across industries, the whole population of the United States, the 5,000. So 40,000 coming from the healthcare
Oh,
segment
that's a
is
lot.
enormous. And that study caused a firestorm, and a lot of people objected to it and said, no, they're not measuring it right. Other people said, yes, they are measuring it right, and we have to get after this. And all kinds of work was done to try to address that. One of the people who worked on that early was Paul O'Neill, who had been the chairman of Alcoa. And I had consulted with him across a 20-year period. So I knew him well, and we both worked on patient safety together. And it was fascinating work, but it was extremely difficult. And part of the difficulty is not having a good outcome measure. So now, subsequent to that, additional studies were done. I reviewed 8 of those studies and published a paper on this subject in a Health Canada journal, a medical journal. And in those studies, the number of people identified as killed in the health by the healthcare system varied from the 40,000 originally up to 200,000. And then recently another study came out that said the real number is 22,000. So the truth is nobody knows. Nobody knows how many people are killed in the healthcare system, patients, that is. And the industry doesn't realize how important that is to performance. So what is measured are individual types of patient safety outcomes. So for example, how many people fall and get killed falling? And in the healthcare world, if you're in the hospital and you're groggy and maybe you have some other kind of condition and so on, falling can kill you. And so it's really important not to fall. And so the number of falls that occur can be tracked, and that is tracked. But it's not comparative across the whole U.S. It's just for our healthcare system. How many did we have? Hospital-acquired infection is another big one, and it's the same thing. So if you ask a CEO of a healthcare organization, how are you doing in patient safety? They'll say, well, we've been working on hospital-acquired infections, and we've lowered that number by 40% over the last 3 years. If you ask them, well, how many overall fatalities have you had? They're likely not going to know because they're not required to report it. So what is needed is a federal standard that says this is the kind of event that you have to report, and over time we'll track that and we'll look at it across the whole country, and then we'll be able to see is the industry getting better or not. And at the individual level of a hospital or a hospital system, we'll be able to track our performance and say there was X and then we've been working on it, it's gone down to Y. But presently that can't be done, or that is not now. That is not being done. And if you talk to leaders about it, they'll say, well, gosh, that's just so complicated. That's a can of worms. We're not sure how we would classify stuff. Sometimes it's not obvious if the patient died because of an error or because of an inevitable process. They came to the hospital sick and they died in the hospital. So that's nobody did anything wrong. No mistake was made. So it is tricky, but those things can be handled. You can find ways to do that measurement. And if there was an outcome measure, it would improve performance. People would then have that feedback mechanism in place, and they'd be able to say we're making progress in a different way than they are today.
You know, Tom, listen to you. It is fact. I mean, I've been in the insurance space, and we work closely with hospitals and healthcare systems and things like that. And I've been in those facilities many, many, many times over. And you're right, you know, and also you're just being in the industry and hearing things and learning about things and reading articles. It is very convoluted. It's very difficult, as you said. I mean, someone can die of, you know, something that started at a hospital, for example, but they would never be able to track that it happened there because the death occurred maybe a week, 2 weeks later. I mean, we do hear stories that happen, you know, not anecdotal stuff, but real. But, you know, people maybe go after a lawsuit, whatever. You hear them in the news, but those are far in between. But there's a lot more stories that people say, you know, true story, this is a long time ago. When I first started in the industry, I was a representative, you know, for a plan, and the plan had clinics around the city. And we were talking to this, you know, senior lady that walked to us just about the insurance fund. And she literally pointed at us and said, your company killed my husband. I mean, literally, she said that. Now, I mean, my partner and I were like, We didn't kill anybody. I mean, we're the insurance company here. She said, well, this company, and I, you know, of course, the name I'm not going to mention, but this particular company, you know, was the cause where my husband died because he went to the clinic, blah, blah, blah. Something happens. They weren't able to help him or they did something wrong. And voila, he was gone. And, you know, so we obviously explained to her that we're not the case. We're an insurance company. We're the same, owned by the same, you know, entity and so on and so forth. But that's something that you can hear all the time, you know, as stories. And again, I'm sharing one that happened just someone came to me in my face and told me that. But it is. And this was like early 90s, you know, and it's we hear those cases. They are out there. And frankly, I can see in a healthcare system how it would be difficult to track, and how, because there's so many moving parts and so many people that are touching an individual patient at any given point. And there are things, you know, maybe the patient didn't do a good job, you know, about maybe following the instructions, and maybe they're caregivers. So there's a lot of things, but it could be also, we heard stories about, you know, things happening in the hospital. And again, I, another personal story, this is not a joke. It happened. Actually, I did a show about it. My mom went to a surgery. They told me that she had a gallbladder, you know, a stone that she needed, you know, it was not, you know, it was about to rupture, whatever. They got to remove the gallbladder. They did the whole surgery. They cut it open, the whole nine, you know, and then she was like, okay. And they gave me a whole report that she was clear and everything. And years later, you know, we did a sonogram. It's like her gallbladder is still there. You know, I'm like, how the hell? Now, luckily nothing happened to her, but that could have been a very simple, you know, mistake that could have caused something else to her. I don't know what it would have been, but at the end of the day, I mean, things happen that you cannot possibly even imagine, right? We've heard of my misdiagnosis cases where people were given, you know, medication when they didn't have to take it. I've had a case where we talked about someone who was diagnosed with cancer, but never had cancer, you know, because it was a mistake. And they went through the whole process of treatment, yet they never had something in the first place. It was a mistake. So these things are real, folks. If you're watching or listening, don't be, you know, scared, because that's reality. And healthcare is difficult to manage. And you're right. Unless there is some legal legislation. I mean, we have a lot of government bodies too. I mean, we're talking about healthcare. We have CMS, for example, Department of Health. We have HHS. We have a lot of different regulatory. We have the CDC giving instructions from one side. We have the World Health Organization giving instructions. But it's all over the place, and it can vary by country. Obviously, when you get into the states, we have even states, local counties, local regulations that can be, you know, changed from one state to the other. So we have a lot of different things. Now, in your word, in your world, rather, how, I mean, is there a particular pattern that you see, you know, that has been happening over and over that actually leads to some of these problems and, or, you know, prevents prevention?
Yeah. So there are cultural variables of that kind that you see that are patterns and that recur over and over and that get in the way. So when I say organizational culture, I mean how we get things done in this organization. So it's not so much what we do that defines the culture, but it's how we do it. And it matters a great deal, for example, how well information flows up in the organization. Now, that's a cultural variable. It's called upward communication. And if upward communication is poor, then the likelihood that events will occur that were unintended is much, much, much higher. So the nurse in the surgical suite may be very reluctant to say something to the surgeon that the surgeon has overlooked. I mean, if doctor, you're on the wrong side of the brain. you're about to go into the wrong Ooh. Side. That feels like it's just out of place for a person to say, a nurse to say to a neurosurgeon. A similar thing happens in the airline industry. The co-pilot, the less senior of the two, is very reluctant to say to the pilot, you're about to go down the wrong runway. Now, that's kind of an extreme example, and it's one that healthcare knows about, and has a lot of things have been done to try to get at that. And some of them have worked pretty well. So often these days, there's a team meeting before the surgery to take that example. And in the team meeting, first they identify they have the right patient, they have the right diagnosis, they have the right people in the room that are going to do that. They go over the game plan, all of them together, and they sort of verify all the basic things. So we've got the right person, we know what we're doing, we got the right people here, we know the sequence, we're all set, ready to go. They have that kind of a pre-meeting, and that's intentional to get at the thing that I've been talking about. And that has helped. That's helped, I think, a great deal. But there's still that difficulty. There's still the difficulty of, if a nurse sees a physician who hasn't washed his or her hands in between patients, is she going to say something or he going to say something? Hand washing, in various studies, is a long ways from 100%. Hand hygiene, physician and nurse hygiene, is a long ways from 100%. But do I feel free in the healthcare system to point that out to somebody? Not really. I don't feel free. I think that might be offensive. I might get snapped at. I might even get on a, you know,
retaliation.
Somebody's bad list, or yeah, retaliation might happen. I mean, all kinds of things. That would be countercultural for me to say to somebody, "Hey, you didn't wash your hands before we walked in there." Would not be a pleasant thing to say. So that's an example, is upward communication. And there are a whole bunch of variables like that that are cultural variables that have been studied in various studies across different organizations and that are applicable to getting good both quality and safety outcomes.
You know, I'm listening to you. We do have advancement in technology now, and you're right. I mean, there's a lot of ways to kind of verify things now. We didn't have those things back in the days. I mean, there have been stories of even like babies being replaced back in the days, you know, and switched, right? You know, but now we have all these tags, we have QR codes, you know, everybody gets scanned, you know, these smart cards that all the nurses, you know, drag around the hospital. I mean, there's a lot more, you know, and I guess with the AI coming on board now, there's going to be a lot more, you know, visual and maybe even, you know, I don't know, they can do a lot of things, you know, with that today. And, but so it will probably help reduce the risk, but you're right. I mean, when it comes to the personal human error, then that's the challenge. And, or as you said, you know, you're my senior, I may not be able to tell you, or maybe I'm afraid for my job, because I don't want to go on the dark list, right? You know, as you said, you know, I want to be able to speak freely. And I know there's some cultures out there of how, you know, healthcare systems, they re-encourage, you know, open discussion, open dialogue, you know, giving feedback, suggestions, anonymous stuff. You know, you can even throw in your stuff without having to name yourself. And by the way, this is in general, I mean, in business cultures, work cultures, we have a lot of that in general work. But here, when it comes to safety, I mean, one of the first, you know, shows I had done years back was about, you know, the scan of items, or like maybe items that are in the surgery, for example, that may be expired, you know, and still being available, like the inventory hasn't been cleaned up or replaced with new stuff, which therefore can cause problems, you know, if it's put into the body, for example, right? Maybe something of that nature. Yeah. So these are things that are real, and there is a little, you know, there's more awareness now. And I think with social media and, you know, folks like yourself, you know, experts are more present, you know, in the discussion. Because I tell you, I mean, before, you know, the social media world, where the podcast, and it was very difficult to hear experts that, you know, other than the curated ones that have been selected to bring a message, right, in the public media. You know, you didn't have that. Now we have a little bit more awareness. I mean, people are coming up, and we see more of that. So there's a lot more, I guess, open, you know, visual stuff about the health, about the systems, about what to say, your bill of rights, and so on and so forth. So it kind of gives a little bit, but it's still, you know, a long way from home, as they say, right? I mean, as you said, the bottom line is we don't have a way to statistically measure all these correctly, and therefore put the mechanics in place that actually prevent all these things. You know, I mean, you can think about a pre-flight checklist, as you said. I mean, we, and by the way, even with pre-flight checklists, I mean, even the, you mentioned airlines, I mean, they do have problems too. Tragedies do occur. I mean, recently, I mean, with that particular flight in DC, I mean, it's like, you know, you would never think that would happen, but it did happen. I mean, so these things do occur, But in the healthcare, as you said, it's very, and you're right, there's different levels of healthcare. Some are private entities, some are more, I guess, profitable than others. Some have, you know, different, you know, funding, and so therefore they may not have all the tools. And again, we can talk about inner cities versus, like, you know, some affluent, you know, systems. All these things are really true valuables that can make a difference. I mean, some people are working on double shift, triple shift, you know, schedule, which they're not operating in optimum health and as just staffing, you know, and schedule. I mean, I was talking to someone. Now we have this new thing that's happening in, at least in some of the systems that I've seen. They have 4-day schedule, you know, a week and 12-hour shifts for nurses. Now, you know, some nurses, I've seen them literally back to back. I mean, they finish a shift, they come back the next day, they get another one. And, you know, I mean, I get it, you know, 12 hours can be a long run. I mean, it might take a toll on someone, you know, mentally or physically. I mean, you tell me, doctor, I mean, Tom, with your background, doesn't that actually scare, you know, people, or at least be a scary thought that someone is actually operating for a long time in these long hours? I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, 12 hours scares me. I think personally, my opinion would be that's not a good schedule. There's just too much risk in the last 4 hours. And if you're really fatigued, you're going to miss things. Going to miss things that you would otherwise not miss. I can see the advantage of then you get an extra day off and you get eight more hours of pay than you would in the standard schedule. But from the standpoint of safety and quality and operational performance, I don't think
I wouldn't recommend it.
No.
Well, you know, it's amazing, because I'm going to give another, you know, true story. And I know you love storytelling, because you use that in your book, and we'll talk about it in a second. I think this will be a great segue to that. But you know, true story, my mom was hospitalized, and because they have these specific, you know, rules and time frames to check in and check out, and she's diabetic, so they had maybe every 2-3 hours they come in and do a poke and check her blood. But at night, I mean, they have those sets are the same, right? And there was a point where she was literally overdosed. And when I mean overdosed, the doctor took the information that I had given them, and he used, you know, the combination of insulin that she's been using, but he was giving her all these things. And one thing they didn't calculate is that it overlaps the time frame. So one insulin shot was still in the works where the other came. And of course, in the hospital system, the food is served early. So by 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, that sugar was way low. Now, and I was literally there with her when her sugar dropped to 30. Now, anyone watching or listening, if you're diabetic, 30 is really, you can lose your consciousness. It can become really bad. And she was getting to that border. Had I not noticed that she was sweating and she was not really 100%, I literally called them. They tried to scramble. You know, I have my honey with me, so I gave her some honey quickly, some orange juice and stuff like that. We boosted it up. But had I not looked at it at that point, following just that procedure, and between the time frame of food and that, it could have been disaster. That could have been a fatality right there, that or irreversible, you know, damage that may have happened, you know, if we didn't save the day literally in an instant, right? And that's a true story that happened, folks. I'm not, you know, it's not a smoke in here. I mean, you know, I do this, you know, for the purpose of educating people, enlightening people. And this is a true story that happened to me. And I was mad. And I mean, I'm being cool now about it. I wasn't that cool then. but just to give you an example of how the system can certainly, you know, wreck this very easily.
Yep.
And by the way, had it happened, let's say it happened, right? I can guarantee you, no one will tell me that's what happened to her. They'll say, oh, she slept and, you know, yep, I don't know what happened. Yep. Complication happened and that's it.
Yep.
'Cause I wasn't even there. So folks, again, when you go there, you got to advocate, you got to monitor. And that's just a quick, you know, tip that I want to give to audiences. If you're with a loved one, you know, make sure you monitor, because don't trust the system 100%. I mean, it's good. You know, 99% of the time, they're going to do a great job. But just be aware, 1% is all it takes or less, yeah, you know, to have bad and stuff. And that's really what we're, you know, worried about. Now, let's talk about your book, If Your Culture Could Talk. You know, there's a lot of stuff. Let's talk about that. And then we can talk about the other book. I mean, you have a couple of them that, you know, we certainly would like to bring to the audiences today. Unless you want to add anything to what I just said.
No, I'm happy to talk about the book. Where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, it's If your culture could talk, I mean, that's pretty deep. You know, let's go there. I mean, that's an interesting title. I mean, you know, with your expertise, the time that you spend, with all the stuff that you've seen, you know, there is a big thing about culture. And, you know, I think maybe if you just can start with defining this culture thing, because when people will think, everybody has a definition of what culture looks like. I mean, today the culture is like, you know, we have to work remotely. We got to do this. Maybe some people think about it. That's what culture means. I don't think that's what the book, you know, is about. So let's deep dive into that and share with them the value of what you have in there.
Yeah. So in working with executives in different industries over the years, culture has become more and more important, and people, executives, are more and more conscious about it. It's in the language. People talk about it. If you talk to an executive, let's say, has 30 plants around the world, and you say, well, what differentiates these 30 facilities? They'll talk about culture. They'll say, well, there's a really good culture at our locations in South America, but in the East or in the Middle East or in parts of North America, the culture is not so good. So they talk about it as if they understand it fully. But if you actually look at individual situations that come up, they don't really understand how they are influencing the culture. They understand that there's a culture. And if you ask them, if you say, well, how does this culture get created? They would say, oh, we leaders, we create the culture. And then, but then if you say, well, how do you do that? I mean, give me an example in the last 3 months about how you have influenced the culture of your organization. Then they're not quite so clear about that. They'll at that point, they'll start to sort of sputter. They don't really have. So what struck me as I was thinking about it, working with different organizations, was that while there's an understanding in a general way of what culture, organizational culture is, it's how we do things around here, what we value, what we think is important, so on. The way that it's influenced by leaders is not very well understood. And so when I was thinking about that one time, I thought, well, wait a minute, what is this thing, culture? I mean, I know, okay, it's how we do things and so on, but isn't it a kind of an odd construction? I mean, it's a thing that exists between people. Like you have a group of people, you have a culture. If you get a group of people together, you get a culture, right? So, but wait a minute, how does that happen? I mean, where does it live, this culture? It's not, if I work with you and there are 10 other people, we're in an organization, we play baseball together, we make something in a manufacturing plant, we work together as a group, we'll develop a culture. But now what is that thing? I mean, where is it? Where is it, in my head? Is it in, it's a shared kind of, what, that's weird, isn't it? What is that? So I was thinking about all of that. And then the idea came to me, well, what if you personified the culture and gave it a voice and then talked to it? What would that conversation consist of? And so I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I started to play around with it, and I wrote a draft, and then I ended up writing a book, which is a story of a senior executive. There's an event, bad event, something blows up, bunch of people get killed. The investigation finds that it was a cultural issue, and this leader, who is a brilliant technical guy, an engineer, he's really good with math and data and technical problems. He's not really good with people. He doesn't exactly like that part of the job. He can do it. He's got other people that do that for him. But he realizes that after this event that he's got to fix the culture, and he realizes he has no idea how to do it. So he goes to sleep, and he has a dream, and in the dream, he meets the culture. And it's a personification. It's some kind of a spirit. And he has conversations with that culture. Now, the advantage of that from a kind of writing authorship standpoint is that then I get to describe a conversation which really never happens but should happen, right. where the leader says to somebody, you know, well, wait a minute, what do you mean I create the culture? What are you talking about? And they say, Well, last week you made a decision in firing somebody, and the way you did that influenced the culture. It wasn't fair. You weren't fair to that person. Not that you shouldn't have fired him, but the way you did that screwed up the culture a little bit. Now, who's going to say that to a CEO? Who's going to tell him that? Nobody's going to tell him that. And so the kind of mechanism in the book is that this culture creature is free to say, to tell him, wait a minute, you don't even know what the hell you're doing. You missed it. You don't even know what's going on here. Come on. And so they have very frank conversations in which the leader gets educated by in a way that is really helpful to him. That's what he really needs, but which is not likely to happen any other way.
Well, you know, Tom, listen to you. It's amazing because what are you describing is the real thing. I mean, it sounds, you know, kind of fictive, you know, because it's the book stuff. But really, you're right. You know, not everybody's going to stand up to a CEO and tell them what's up. And I think this is when we get into the level of leadership and who are the leaders. And not all leaders are made equal. Some have the ability to create good culture. And by that, I mean that they allow that open door policy. Feedback is welcome, and you know, doing things the right way as opposed to, like you said, it's just how you do things, right? You know, you can fire people for performance for whatever good reason, but you know, it's how you do it. I mean, it has to be in the right way, and it's not condescending. There's a protocol to do things right, no matter what they are. Business is business. We get this. Everybody watching, listening, you know, again, coming from leadership myself, and you know, having to do determinations, you know, protocols myself. It is probably the worst part of your job, no matter what leadership level you are, when you have to make those decisions. But it's how you conduct it and how you address it and how you present that, you know, that ultimate thing. So did you get all the pieces in place before you even got to that point? All the stuff, it's not for spite. It's not because, you know, I don't like this guy, you know, because he challenges me all the time. Let's just get rid of him. It's not that. So there's all that. So how you develop that, that's a big deal. And so in your expertise and experience, you know, I know there's different types of leaders. You know, what should we look in general? I mean, if we are leaders out there watching or listening, what, you know, let's have this conversation with that person, the culture person right now. What do we need to look for to actually prevent horrible incidents and high risk situations, events to occur in our, you know, workplace, whether it's healthcare or otherwise?
So a good place to start is to examine the decisions that you're making, excuse me, and ask yourself, this decision that I'm making, what effect is that going to have on the culture of this organization? So we're doing a restructuring. We realize we've got some issues, some people left, and some new products came in, and some new facilities were built, and so the structure that we have had is no longer appropriate to what we've got. So we're going to restructure things. That means we're going to lay a few people off, we're going to hire some new people, we're going to build some new facilities, we're going to bring in some different technology. It's a big shakeup. And that's a complicated technical set of variables to get your head around. And we got a team, and the team's got various skill sets and knowledge bases and so on, and they've got a budget, and they're set down to figure this out. You're going to figure out how to configure things in such a way that it suits the goals of the new organization that we are forming. So they're having conversations about how many people should there be in each of these facilities, where should the technology be in different plants, what's the structure going to be in terms of reporting relationships? Is it going to be flat? Is it going to be steep with various layers? And in the course of all of that work, is there consideration being given to what the cultural impact of those decisions is? And the answer is usually not. Usually it's a technical question. Wait a minute, what does that mean? What kind of culture are we going to get when we do that? It doesn't come up. It's not that they thought about it and said, well, we don't care. If we have a 12-hour shift, that's going to work. That 12-hour shift thing is a great idea for our budget. Yeah, it turns out that that's favorable in a bunch of different ways to the whole business plan. So let's do that. But the question of, well, wait a minute, what about the culture? What effect is that going to have on the people who work here? That may or may not come up. And more often than not, it does not come up. And it's hard to see. I mean, I'll tell you a story in my own case where I was the one who did this in my company. This is the company that I built up and sold 2012. It was a couple hundred people, global, really nice, really good consulting organization. And we would track how we were doing in the marketplace. If there was a big project we wanted and we were in competition with other consulting companies, we would track when we won and when we lost. And in a relatively short period, we lost three big deals, and ones that I thought we were going to get, that I thought we should have gotten, and we didn't get them. Somebody else did. And so we thought, man, I wanted to know what that was about. So we got some people together and we interviewed people, the people who had chosen another consulting firm. We interviewed them. And they said, your folks came across as arrogant and inflexible. And man, that was like, holy cow, that's about the worst thing I could imagine that I would want to come across to a client, prospective client. Your folks are arrogant and inflexible. And so I began thinking about how have I contributed to that? And I realized that I used to love to brag about how much better we were than our competitors. And I thought we were better. I still think we were better. I mean, we had...
It's how you presented that and how they took it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. But you know, Tom, I'm listening to you, right? So this is something that I've experienced myself, you know, in the workspace. You know, I think companies that are small versus companies that are large. I think when the larger the companies get, the least, I think, you know, culturally they become really aware. Because it becomes strictly business. Decisions are made really for like P&L, let's make it work, you know, how much damage we're going to do, how well we're going to beat the competition, like you said. And you're right, the arrogance does take place, like we are it, right? So, and I think that's when you start losing your crowd. And in a way, some, you don't get the right feedback from your team or you don't care anymore. The other one is, as you said, maybe you create that pompous attitude where these people would walk like, you know, they're actually walking on, you know, in the air, right? You know, so it becomes a different thing. Because like you work, like you talk to someone from maybe a large company. Well, I work for this company. Okay. You know, and you know, some small companies are just building up, you know, whatever it is. But what I realized that the smaller companies, they have a more enclosed environment. Everybody kind of knows everything about everything. The communication is easier up and down, as you said. You know, again, that's the other thing. The layers that you have in large companies, sometimes that communication doesn't even ascend. I mean, it just stays local. You know, you got so many multiple layers, supervisor, this and the other, manager, senior manager, you know, AD, AVP, VP, and it goes, I mean, it never gets to the top. And, you know, and so that, and a lot of these folks on the top, they don't even mingle with, the entry level, you know, team. Right. And it makes a very different, you know, world to operate. And you're right. And that can cause that feeling that nobody cares about me. That's the other thing. When you're not caring about your team in a way where they see it, and that's the other, it's not how you think, it's how, you know, you got to do, like, you know, like what would work for you. Now, of course, you don't just accept everything that, because they might tell you whatever they want, like it's a walk in the park. It's still a business. You're still responsible, but there's ways to do this. But the idea is that sometimes you lose everybody because they don't even care about the company. They will damage the company just by default, because sometimes for spite, like I don't, and I've seen it. I mean, you sometimes you review, you go to reviews, right? For a company specific, like it's a 2-star, you know, 1.5. I mean, it's bad. And it's thousands of employees over the years that put in that. And you go, and I've worked in a company, and I went, I'm like, folks, you're not getting any new talent because if someone checks the reviews, why would they work here? You know, not, and I've worked in companies that were actually top 50, you know, employers in New York City, for example, right? Big, right? And so you can see that really differentiator between a top company that is building a character of all the company, and everybody's kind of aligned in a way. And so when you say we need safety is first, right? We got to do whatever it takes for our patients or members or whatever. You can see that across everyone down the line, as opposed to on a different culture where that's not happening. Everybody's on its own. They do whatever they think that's possibly the right way to do it. And maybe they're making mistakes and they don't even care. Cause like if something happens, well, too bad. I wasn't given the tools. I wasn't this, and I'll give an excuse and that's about it. So it's very dangerous, you know, worlds that, you know, out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And healthcare is more challenging than most organizations because it's not a typical hierarchy. I mean, it's not like a manufacturing plant, you know, has a plant manager and eight people that report to the plant manager, and each of those has eight people, and it's like a structure, a hierarchical structure. In a healthcare system, you have a physician population that has a lot to say about what's going to happen and how things are done. But then you have nursing and other kinds of healthcare categories who are related to a structure, but in which the physician is not exactly part of. They're over and above, but not exactly part of. So it's an atypical kind of organizational structure, and that brings problems with it. Getting that right, getting good organizational functioning, meaning good decision making, happens is very challenging in that kind of an environment.
Well, working in silos, by the way, that kills me in a lot of organizational stuff, where you have departments that operate, but they're not in sync, they're not communicating properly, they each does their own, and almost like in a competitive way or a challenging way. I mean, as opposed to like, we're doing this together, we run this show, you run this, and together we make it work. And again, by the way, folks, you're watching, listening, this is 1 hour is not enough for this discussion. There's a lot more deep stuff. You know, we're just bringing in the highlight here. But really, there's so much stuff in this, you know, discussion in terms of leadership, decision making, the values, the employees, the mind. I mean, it could be as simple as, do we even pay our people the right way? Do we have the right, you know, set of benefits? Because if someone works, they have no choice. They get the job because they have to pay the bills. Maybe they're not happy. They're just kind of like, you know, coming and clocking in and out. They're going to do the bare minimum, you know. Do we go beyond the call of duty, you know, with our team? Do we see that everybody is kind of like well compensated in the competition space, and based on their level, that they're not going to look at the other stuff and they're going to give more? And I personally believe that's the way it should be. You know, you do the right thing by your team. And if you do that, the rest is history. They'll take care of everything for you, and they will be, and you give them the leverage, you give them the empowerment, and so on and so forth. But you're right. The example that you give is perfect. Nurses operating, they have their own hierarchy. Doctors, they have, and then of course we're talking healthcare. There's a lot of ego. Let's call it for what it is. You know, a lot of you know, what do you call those added letters behind your name? You know, that kind of give you a little bit of a tweak there. You know, so it is power and driven, and so there's that, you know, challenge and stuff. And by the way, you know, Tom, I've seen this in the same healthcare system. In one of the examples, they have different hospitals. Every hospital has its own president. They run differently. I've actually experienced two sets. When I talked about my mom, you know, same system, two separate hospitals, two different president, you know, leadership. Communication was completely different in one versus the other. I actually had to challenge them about just one thing, and I won because, you know, I'm like, you guys literally in your communication across the system, you have this service and you're denying the service to me here. Meanwhile, it is on the stuff. Here's an ID that I had on the other side as a companion for my mother. Oh, we don't have this. You can't have this. No, a companion is not a guest. It's not a visitor. I am actually here to assist. And so just as simple as that, same system, two different sets of leadership, two different, you know, communication, you know, hand down, and a total loss in one versus the other. And it's a true example, folks. You know, like, don't think that it's just one brand. Everybody's like, it's like a franchise. You have the same, you go to the same store, one is run terrifically, you know, well, and the other one's like a bad element, right? And that's exactly what happens in our world of healthcare. So it's crazy. Yeah. So Tom, let's, you know, I mean, are there practices, best practices that you would like to just kind of hit us with? Boom, boom, boom. Maybe, I don't know, top five.
I think from a leadership standpoint, maybe the first thing to emphasize is listening, learning how to listen. And that's not an easy thing to do. Leaders are accustomed to giving direction, to coming up with solutions, to having the communication go that way, me to you, I'll tell you. And so it doesn't come natural to the leader always or many times to see their job as taking information in. And that means really listening carefully. So what is it that this employee is wanting to tell me? And not only what they're willing to tell me, because they're not going to just tell me the real stuff. everybody does these walk-arounds, right? So the leaders go where they walk around. How are things going? What's happening? What kind of problems are you having? What are your challenges? Tell me what's going on here. People don't tell them what's going on. they tell them what they think they want to hear. And so being able to actually listen to what people are saying, to capture what it is that they're saying, and then give an indication of what you heard. So say it back to them. So what you're saying is that the way this system is designed, you really don't have sufficient time to do the things that you think are important that need to actually be done to get good quality and good safety in this situation. That's what you're telling me. When you say that, then they'll tell you more. And you feed that back and they'll tell you more. And you can actually have a conversation where the employee feels like, that guy really listened to me. And I told him, you know, here's what's going on here. Here's what we're doing here. When we get short-staffed, we're running around here like crazy trying to get it all done. And stuff falls through the cracks at that point. They'll tell them. So I think I think listening is a really big piece. And then a second piece that comes to mind is providing support for what is needed to reach an objective. So we give the employee an objective. We would like you to see X number of patients or deliver X number of widgets or whatever it is, get this amount of work done in this time frame. But do we give them the support that they need to get that done? And in some cultures, the thing is, we tell you the goal. Now it's your job to go figure out how to get to that goal. In the best culture, we give you a goal, but then we also ask you and look at what you're doing and try to make a determination about whether or not you have the support that you need to achieve that objective. And if we see opportunities, then we can provide that support. Those are some things that I would say.
Oh, those are superb. I mean, they're huge. And by the way, those are like pillars. if we can apply those two alone, I mean, it would be a tremendous change, right? And by the way, I personally seen leaders who actually had that capability and the ability to bring in people every month, bring in different people, different layers, different levels, and just hear them out, you know, and really, you know, talk up, you know, no holding. There's no retaliation. It's just, we want to see what's going on, because again, sometimes the people that know most are the people that are in the front of the audiences, right? You know, the people behind, you know, the back scenes and the backstage, they're not seeing the real action. And, you know, we can maybe imagine what it looks like, but it's not. I mean, to your point, if you're in the corporate, you know, headquarter of whatever system, you're very rarely seeing what's going on in the front side. But if you go to a patient, you know, clinic, for example, and you see how crazy it can get, you know, the pressure, the noise, people get attitude and all the stuff, people are complaining, maybe the hygiene, all the stuff is a whole thing. And the people that are working that front line, they're the ones who are facing this day in and out, and maybe they're not very comfortable. So yeah, it changes the dynamics with someone. And I love what you said about listening, because true leaders have to also be somewhat, you know, good followers, and definitely, you know, you cannot possibly be a good leader if you're not an able, you know, follower. You know, what makes a good leader is the ability to do both. I mean, I can lead or I can follow, but also I can absorb information. I can get that without having to undermine, without having to kind of really scare people, like, you know, have them fear of my position or title. And I think sometimes that authority does play, and, you know, people don't, oh, I'm not going to talk to CEO. Who am I, right? And that's the other thing. I think, like, for me, for example, over the years, I've realized one thing. I mean, these are titles, ranks. You know, at the end of the day, you know, like, I give this example all the time in my trainings. You know, I am at the highest level in sales, right? And my rep is my initial, you know, that's the entry point to the department, right? But guess what? We're the same. We both are representative of the company. We both actually are soldiers. We just have different ranking based on our experience in the trenches. And, you know, and I do exactly what they do, and I cannot, you know, possibly tell my team to do something if I can't do it myself, you know, in a way. And that's just my personal, you know, motto, right? But at the end of the day, that could be the same for everyone. I mean, yeah, obviously everybody's got different expertises and things like that. You know, sometimes the CEO is not a doctor, right? You know, and it's a business person, right? They run the operation. There's a CEO. Now, that's why you have a chief medical officer. They run the medical stuff. But sometimes they're not really doing stuff. And I've worked actually with medical directors, because in the insurance space, we have them. You know, sometimes we don't see eye to eye because their decisions, you know, they may know stuff on the medical side, but we bring in the feedback. This is not what's being asked and wanted in the community. We got to do some stuff. The doctors are not happy. For example, in my world, we talk to doctors all the time. And if doctors are working with all the other insurance companies, talking about competition, they give you the same feedback. Like, we don't like your plan because of XYZ, right? And so now you bring that back, like, oh, we can't do it that way. Well, you can't be in the same place as the other guys and expect the results that the other guys are having if you don't change XYZ, right? So those are some of the things. But, you know, thank you for, like, really throwing those two. These are powerful ones. And I think if you're watching, by the way, if you are an employee, just a staff member, you know, when I say just a staff member, you are a valuable person. But, you know, maybe you can bring this up, you know, to the next level. If you have access to the top, you know, go for it. You know, there's no reason why not to. And if you are in a level where you can make a decision, you know, maybe it's time to reevaluate. I mean, it's all about that. We can reevaluate ourselves. We're not always perfect. We're never going to be that perfect. And things change. I mean, times, like, for example, today, we're AI driven, right? Do we want to live in the space where, you know, there is no AI? I mean, you could, but you're going to miss a lot. You know, it's just simple, right? And we can use that to our advantage. And in the healthcare, I think that's coming up. A lot of countries that we thought they were behind are ahead of us now with AI. I mean, that's the sad thing. And again, we're in the U.S. Our healthcare, it is still turmoil. I mean, it's not perfect. There's a lot of work to be done. So I know there's another book, you know, which is Taking the Lead in Patient Safety. Now, I'm assuming that's a good book for people, like, to really just, you know, read and boom, 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 follow some of the directives there and instructions on really how to do it, right? Because that's driven from your, you know, arsenal and ammo of expertise that you've collected over the years. So I think that's a good one. Now, your group, Krauss Bell Group, now, is that a consultant group? And, you know, how does someone work with you?
It's a small consulting group, but we have a portfolio of clients. We have a group in Europe. We have some in South America. We have some in the U.S. And we take on clients, anything from a small manufacturing plant with a few hundred people up to a giant global corporation that's got thousands and thousands of employees. We've done a bunch of research on decision making. And the work of Daniel Kahneman and decision biases and so on. So we're research oriented, and our task is to stay in touch with the social science research that's out there and then figure out how it applies to organizations that want to improve safety and want to improve culture.
Ooh, all right. Well, you know, we do want people to check you out, check, you know, the group and the website, and hopefully, you know, if there is a fit, I'm sure, I think people can use your expertise, because we just need it. You know, here's a very simple thing that I'm going to ask, you know, people watching and listening, especially if you are in a capacity of leadership. You know, you can look at it from the inside is one thing, but when someone comes from the outside, there's always something they're going to find. That's just rule, you know, because fresh eyesight, you know, they come in, they see the different things that, because once we see things over and over, we don't see them anymore. I just like the natural process. Someone comes in. So it's always worth it to do a little checkpoint, you know, with someone that has the expertise that can see and highlight some of the, I guess, deficiencies or weaknesses that we have. And it's not going to hurt, right? Because we can reinforce our structures and maybe we can prevent some deadly stuff. Or even financial, because if you do have deadly results or outcomes, that actually comes with price that you pay, whether it's, government issues that you're going to have with licensing. It could be with lawsuits, financial loss. It could be a media reputation that can drop, and then therefore you can lose a whole thing. So there's a lot of stuff that can happen. So it is worth it to do the right thing and, you know, maybe get some expertise every now and then. And yes, everybody is expert at what they do. But there's always someone that knows a little bit better or different. So I think that's just my little two cents in there. Any last words of wisdom you want to share with our audiences today?
I don't think so. Maybe one thing I would say is if you haven't read Edward Deming, his book I would recommend is Out of the Crisis. It's old. It's written in the 80s. But he got it right way early. And I would recommend that book.
Old is our goodies. We love them. I mean, it's got the wisdom, right? Yeah. That's where the expertise is. I mean, you know, and then, by the way, you're right. Some people may have read the book, but maybe not a lot. I haven't read it. And so I think I'd be the first one to actually, you know, add it to my collection. And frankly, it's pretty good stuff. I mean, again, thank you for that advice. And that's powerful. I mean, I'm sure we can learn quite a bit from that same book. And it, listen, it influenced you and you used it too. So it certainly helped, you know, a lot of ways what you do. And certainly we can use it across the board. So if you're watching and listening, you know, this is it. Well, I want to say Dr. Tom, Thomas Krause, thank you so much for being with us and for the insights that you shared with us. So much value that we have here. And folks, that's about it. We're coming to the end of the show. We'll be talking soon. We'll be talking soon. We'll be talking soon.